This is recorded on the morning of July 22nd, 1969. This is an interview between Professor Eccles of the History Department and Dean Andre A. Potter, Dean of Engineering at Purdue. This is tape number 4, recounting Professor Potter's life and professional reminiscences. This is a continuation of our last interview, and we were talking about heads of departments and men whom you had, with whom you had worked at Purdue. And would you like, have we done enough on this? Would you like to add anything to the list of people we were discussing?
I'd like very much to add several names. First of all, Willard A. Knapp, K-N-A-P-P, who was a structural engineer teaching structures in the School of Civil Engineering. And shortly after I came to Purdue University, he impressed me with his open-mindedness, his way of handling people, his keen sensitivity to human interests and reactions. And I arranged for him to give me part-time. Also, he was one of the few who particularly approved my plan of introducing the engineering students during the beginning of the freshman year to some real engineering problems. In fact, he worked out a series of engineering problems that had been copied by a number of institutions all over the country. He served with great distinction as my right-hand colleague, as Associate Dean of Engineering. He never was too busy to see a student or a staff member or to help them. I had a case of a young man who was totally blind, whose father was a rather eminent member of the engineering profession. The boy entered here, and W.A. Knapp arranged so that he was able to carry his objects, although he couldn't write an examination, he couldn't see, but he had a very fine memory. And that young man graduated and has had a very successful career as a inventor and engineer. Another person I should mention is Bill Miller, an individual whom I met when he was superintendent of the boxboard plant in Lafayette, Indiana. My wife wanted to get some cardboard for an old kitchen table. And I thought, I think we ought to get some cardboard. When I went over there, Miller spotted me and showed us the processes for the manufacture of cardboard. And the way he spoke impressed my wife. And she says, there is a real great teacher. And shortly after that, we lost one of our young people. And I suggested to G.A. Young, then head of mechanical engineering, that they look into the availability of Miller. We arranged first on a part-time so he could continue as superintendent of the boxboard plant, and later on a full-time. He was an expert in heating and ventilating. He never was too busy to help a student. He was one of those few people whose percentage of failures was very small, but the accomplishments of his students was outstanding. A third person of unusual personality was Ben Petty in civil engineering. I had a good deal of vision, and ingenuity. He was one of the leaders in developing our contacts in road building. In fact, I would credit him a good deal for the support which Purdue has received from the state of Indiana in connection with the Joint Highway Research Project. Still another person is worthy of mention is Howland, W. Howland, a teacher of sanitary engineering, a graduate of MIT, received his doctorate at Harvard. He was very much of a scholar. I knew his father, who was also a graduate of MIT in engineering, but never practiced, went into the engineering profession, but had a store in New England and a rather successful career. Holland was full of ideas and expressed himself much better than the ordinary person. I think he had a great deal to do over the long period he served with you in enhancing the interest of his colleagues as well as of his students in general education. There are a number of other people here I could speak for hours telling you about the outstanding people at Purdue, whom I found when I came here, and those who developed since I started. Outside of Indiana, probably one of the most colorful people that I would like to mention are the following. First, Mortimer E. Cooley, who was Dean of the College of Engineering of the University of Michigan for many years. Cooley was a humanist, not particularly strong in areas as far as theoretical engineering is concerned, but a person who had fine judgment, great sense of humor. He was a graduate of Annapolis, served for a while in the Navy, and then, as was the case those days, people thought we'll never have another war. He was retired rather early, went to the University of Michigan as a teacher, and became later on professor of mechanical engineering and then dean of the College of Engineering. An incident about Cooley will interest you. During the earlier years of my connection with Purdue, an exchange was arranged by the deans of engineering at Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Ohio State, and Purdue. Each institution had its dean spend 1 week a year at a sister institution in this part of the country. The institution to which he belonged paid his salary. The institution where he went to spend a week paid his transportation and living expenses. And that resulted, that scheme resulted into a very fine cooperative relationships throughout the Middle West and a very substantial reduction in costs, because instead of duplicating everything, we cooperated. I had students, advanced students, who were working for advanced degrees, who were working for thesis at another institution or spending part time there. We cooperated in many ways. On one of my trips, exchange trips, to Ann Arbor, I became better acquainted with Mortimer Cooley. He invited me to come to Ann Arbor at the time when Shelly Appin, the great Russian musician was performing, was giving a performance. President of Michigan, who was Burton at that time, B-U-R-T-O-N, another very delightful personality, knew that that Shalyapin and I had certain things in common, and after the performance we went over to the Burton home. Shalyapin and I sung and played Russian folk songs. That was a Saturday night. Next morning, Sunday morning, Cooley, I stayed at the Cooley home. Those days we used to put up our guests at our own homes. We had a most delicious breakfast of baked herring. Then on my return, when I sent my bread and butter letter to him, I told him that I know of any food that pleased me more than the herring which is served for breakfast. And I told him that I'd like to know where he gets that herring, how he selects it, and how he prepares it and cooks it and so forth. The following Saturday morning, the Saturday following that Sunday, I heard my secretary in the outer office giggling. There was a long telegram, not a night letter or a day letter, but a telegram from Mortimer McCooley, who told me that he was pleased that his ability as a cook impressed me, and he don't want me to lose another Sunday morning without having that type of herring, and he hopes that I will pardon that he is sending the information in this telegram by telegram rather than by letter, but he thought that it would be unfortunate if I missed another Sunday without having herring for breakfast. And he went on describing on and on and on. And there were 150 or so words. And a few weeks later, there was the annual meeting of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Most of us who were on the board of the ASME at that time stopped at the old Astor House. Muschenheim, who was a manager of the Astor House for many, many years, was a mechanical engineer, a graduate of the Stevens Institute of Technology. He used to make a special effort to accommodate members of the council and officers of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers at his hotel.
What town was this?
Pardon me?
What town?
New York City.
New York.
Kula and I usually had rooms on the fifth floor, either room 505. My wife and I had 505, and we paid a magnificent sum of $4 or $5 a day for the two of us for a twin bedroom. And when we came to the meeting, I ran across Cooley, one of the first people, and he said to me, he said, "You know the Shalyapin is singing Boris Godunov at the Metropolitan Opera." I said, "Yes." I said, "I got tickets for Mrs. Parami. We are going there tonight." "What? Where did you get tickets?" he said. I said, "Oh, I just got it at the box office. No trouble." He says, "Could you get me some tickets?" I said, "Yes, I can get you tickets if you're not too particular about price. I may have to get it from O'Brien's, who sell tickets, whose business it is to secure tickets." I said, "I'll get you some very good seats." And he said, "You tell them to send my bill to the Astor House, room 531, whatever it was, and I'll pay the Astor House for it." So that night, when we went to Grand Opera, and after enjoying, until intermission, a most magnificent performance on the part of Shalyapin, we, as usually, took a walk around in the intermission, and there was Cooley, and he held up his hand, his fist at me, and Well, we finished the performance the next morning after the meeting of the Council of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Cooley came up to me, didn't say anything about the opera or any of that sort. He says, you know, I succeeded in getting some unusual oriental rugs, and I have a couple that I want you to have particularly. And I said to him, I said, now, Dean Cooley, I'm sorry, but my wife and I have all the oriental rugs we can possibly use. He says, you never have enough oriental rugs. He says, you can put one on top of the other. He says, they're treasures. And I said, well, I don't think I can do it at this time. But he kept on nagging at me, but I stuck out because I knew what he was trying to do. He was trying to pawn off some poor rugs on me. He was that sort of a fellow, beautiful disposition. And suddenly a person worthwhile, Dougal C. Jackson, who was a consulting engineer in Chicago, had an office in Chicago while he was professor of electrical engineering at the University of Wisconsin, made a great reputation as a consulting electrical engineer. He's another personality who made a very distinctive contribution not only to electrical engineering, but to all types of engineering education, the country over. The third person that I would mention is Charlie Scott, who was for many years a very prominent engineer at the Westinghouse. He was the inventor of the Scott connection, which has been used for much more than a half a century, most beneficially in connection with the electrical power generation. Scott, after serving with great distinction the Westinghouse Electrical Company, accepted a professorship at Yale University. He was not a great teacher. He was a little bit too distant from his students, but his broad experience and his unusual personality contributed greatly to the development and prestige of the Sheffield Scientific School of Yale University. I will go on and tell you of many others, but this gives you an idea of some of the greats at Purdue and the greats outside.
Well, this is certainly marvelous to have all this. There are two general headings of general topics that I would like to go into before we finish, and that I think would be particularly interesting for the Purdue Archives, is can you tell, as much as you wish or discuss, the appointment of Mr. Hubby? How was he appointed? I think that was a question I was asked.
Well, on the Board of Trustees, at the time Mr. Elliott retired, was Catherine McHale. She had a PhD, she was a Logansport girl, a sister of McHale, who was very prominent in the politics of the Democratic Party of this state, and a very high-grade and cultured sort of a person. She was speaking to Vannevar Bush, who headed the wartime program, which made use of the best this country has in scientists. And Vannevar Bush said, when she asked him if he had any suggestions, says there's a young man who succeeded in bringing about a cordial relationship between the British and the United States during the earlier part of the Second World War. His name is Fred Hubby. is a graduate of Minnesota, was very active and prominent in athletics, was a Rhodes Scholar. He's something of a chemist and an engineer. He's at the present time in charge of the rocket research for the research program of the government. So Miss McHale communicated her findings to the trustees, Mr. Hillebrand, who was chairman of the board at that time, from Batesville, a Batesville manufacturer, Bill Henley, W.A. Henley, a graduate of Purdue, a past president of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, and vice president of Eli Lilly, was another person. Louis Ruthenberg, who was at that time, I believe, president of Savelle at Evansville, Indiana. Charlie Cole of South Bend, another alumnus of Purdue, who was a prominent consulting engineer in South Bend. And several others of the board members were very much interested in it. Actually, what happened was, when the war started, there was a very, very poor communication between the American scientists and those in England. Mr. Harvey, having been a Rhodes Scholar, was suggested to Jim Conant, president of Harvard, who was at that time one of the team which was headed by Vannevar Bush. And Conant thought it would be well to open up a London office with Fred Harvey in charge. Now, his keen appreciation of the philosophy of the people on the British Isles, and his understanding of engineering and technical problems, scientific problems, brought about a relationship between Britain and the United States in the area of interchange of science information, which was most helpful to the war effort. So the board invited Mr. Harvey to come to Purdue for an interview. He made a very good impression on the members of the board. Allison Stewart, who was one of the top members of the board, was the person who was particularly impressed by him and who arranged to take him around. In fact, the board asked me to call up some of my friends whose judgment I value and have the telephone conversation transcribed so there wouldn't be any question of my memory, which I did. I interviewed James Conant, president of Harvard, Carl Compton, president of MIT, was called out from commencement exercises by his wife when I made a telephone call. And the third one was Noyes, who was Mr. Harvey's colleague at Rochester University, where he had been teaching and also an assistant to the president in connection with alumni relations. And I had those things transcribed. I had only one copy typed. I turned over that copy to Allison Stewart, who was the one who suggested. And I destroyed the record in the presence of Mr. Stewart and Mr. Henley, so that nobody could go ahead and make statements. But the views which I received about Mr. Harvey pointed out the things which contributed so greatly to his success during the past 22 or 23 years. First of all, he's a thoroughly civilized individual. Secondly, he's not little. Thirdly, he has the ability to think in big units. And fourthly, he is willing to exert himself so as to improve some of his shortages. When he came to Purdue, he had very little experience in public speaking, and for a while it was difficult for him. Those who have heard Dr. Frederick L. Lawson Hovde during the last few years realize what an achievement it was for him to be able to speak as he does. Right in connection with that, I think Purdue has been very fortunate to have the kind of presidency it had. The president best known to me were Stone, of whom I spoke before, who to my way of thinking is one of the greatest presidents I've known at the Leningrad College. Eliot was entirely different from Stone. Entirely different. But he was a builder. He should be credited that with the selection of Robert B. Stewart as manager of the business end of the university and of developing the physical plant. I think Eliot's contribution, the greatest contribution, was to the physical plant and not to staff selection or development. Then comes Hovde. Again, his way of doing things, his manner, has contributed to the continuous growth of Purdue University during a different period where problems were entirely different. Yes.
All right. Now there's a problem that we would like to have on tape, and I think I'd like to have you talk about it. But I don't know where to start. I'll let you start on it. And that is, you have had many honorary degrees. Could you discuss not how you got them, of course, that's obvious, but something about each of the degrees that you've had, honorary degrees?
Well, I'll have to tell you a story about Charlie Schwab, who was a most colorful individual and was the top person in the steel industry during the 20s, not only in this country but in the world. He was a member, he was president, he served as president of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers in 1927. At one of the meetings of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, Charlie Schwab came up to me as president, and he said, "Now I'm meeting a number of college professors who are called deans." He says, "Most of them are such dignified looking individuals." He says, "You look more like an ordinary steel maker. What is a dean?" I told him, "A dean is a college professor who outlived his usefulness as a teacher and is a little too young to pension." He says, "How old were you when you were made dean?" I said, "I was made as a dean. People found out early in my life that I'll never make a great teacher. So they made me a dean in 1913, when I was just a little over 30 years of age. But I fooled them because I continued my teaching throughout my career as dean. I enjoyed teaching more than anything else, and that's why I continued it." Now about the Charlie Schwab again, quoting him again. One time I saw him as he had returned from Germany, where they had a reunion of the steel people, the leaders in the steel industries of Europe, the United States, and other parts of the world. And Charlie Schwab, discussing that reunion, that meeting, said that Karl Krupp, who was at that time head of the steel industry in Germany, says, came into the dinner of the meeting all decked out in medals. And I said to him, Karl, where'd you get all those medals? How did it happen? And he says, well, I'll tell you, Mr. Schwab. He says, the big medal in the center with the diamond was given to me by the Kaiser by mistake. And the other medals were awarded to me because I had this medal. Now that answers your question very briefly. People throughout my career were extremely generous to me. In 1925, after I had been at Purdue University nearly 4 years, my former institution, the Kansas State Agricultural College, now called Kansas State University, realizing that I was not bright enough ever to earn a PhD degree, decided to give me an honorary degree of Doctor of Engineering. And so that's the way it started. Then the others, there was an honorary degree of Doctor of Science came next from Northeastern University, an institution which I mentioned to you before, which interested me greatly, by reason of the fact that it was developing part-time instruction and evening classes for the benefit of people who couldn't afford to stop their work, but they had to learn while they were working. They gave me an honorary degree of Doctor of Science. Then I have just about a dozen of honorary degrees, including South Dakota School of Mines, Northwestern University.
Is yours an LLD at Northwestern?
I have one LLD. No, my LLD comes from Norwich University.
Norwich.
Which is the Norwich at Northfield, Vermont, which is the oldest engineering school in the world, in the country.
Older
he taught
than
engineering. He had courses in engineering in the earlier part of this century.
But older than century. West Point?
Before West Point was started in 12.
Yes.
In 1812.
Yes.
He had a professor of military, of mathematics and the sciences, who taught surveying and mechanics and a few things of that sort. And while the first degree granting institution in the country was the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute at Troy, New York, which was started at 1823. But actually, the first institution that gave some instruction in engineering was Norwich, and then the second was West Point, which trained military officers, but gave quite a little bit of engineering in the early days.
Well, I thought it was primarily an engineering school,
and it's,
military engineering.
Where?
West Point.
No, yeah, when it started, there was a good deal of theoretical engineering. And West Point was really patterned after Ecole DuPont or Chaussée, which was the first engineering school in the world. That school was started, I think I'll have to check dates. Excuse me.
That was during the French Revolution, wasn't it?
No, I'll tell you exactly if you could let me have just a few minutes. I'll get some dates.
All right, we'll go off the tape for a second. All right, we'll go back on the tape now. You're talking about when West Point, Ecole
yeah.
Polytechnique in West Point.
Well, France was the first country in the world to conceive that effective use of science in industry and public works requires a highly selected and specially trained personnel in schools of high rank. Louis XV, who lived from 1715 to 1754, undertook to repair the economic structure of France after its terrible wars by appointing Père Ronet, P-E-R-R-O-N-N-E-T, in 1747 as chief engineer of bridges and highways to build a system of national highways and to improve the public works of France. He was charged, I quote from his order, with the direction and supervision of surveyors and designers of plans and maps of roads and highways of the realm and of all those who are appointed and nominated for such work, and to instruct the said designers in the sciences and practices needed to fulfill with competency the different occupations relating to such public works. Quotation closed. See, this commission gave Père Ronet, made Père Ronet the father of engineering education in the world. As before 1747, engineers had prepared for the calling entirely through apprenticeship.
It's interesting that Purdue
to master builders, an isolated and unorganized studies. Père Ronet transformed his staff into a veritable school of student engineers in 1747.
Well?
Now, in addition to professors which he trained, he employed professors from the outside, from Sorbonne, some of the other older schools in France. Now, this school I visited, they called the Pont de Chaussée, when I was in France in 1954. And this school has retained its original characteristics to this day, with students ranking as state employees and the professors, even today, are in part eminent scholars from universities who drive over, give the lectures, and then drive right back, and in part leading engineers of the core of the Pont de Chaussée. That's the core of public works. Now, West Point originally was very much like École de Pont de Chaussée. Of course, the École de Polytechnique, which was started in France in 1795, greatly influenced West Point. In fact, as time went on, I think the pattern was changed. The pattern of West Point was changed from that of École de Pont de Chaussée to the École de Polytechnique. You see, the École de Polytechnique is rather interesting. Well, it was started definitely as a high-grade engineering school. It was responsible for such scholars as Lagrange and Laplace in mathematics, Prony in mechanics, Monge, M-O-N-G-E, in descriptive geometry, and Berthollet in chemistry. You see, in France, until very recent years, to be a graduate of École de Polytechnique was prestige of the very, very highest order.
I understand in electrical engineering, to be a graduate of the École was probably the highest, meant the highest academic training a man could have.
He was the highest academic, and he was sought for public works.
Now
so, for public position. It's rather uncanny, Doctor, you as a historian, you know it, what a large portion of the leaders in France, particularly during the latter part of last century and the first part of this century, were educated at the École Polytechnique.
Now we're getting away from something, though. We're getting away from the story of the rest of the honorary degrees. We got stopped with Norwich. What other universities have honored you?
I'll have to get the list.
Let's just stop for a second. Go off the tape. All right. Now we're back on the tape.
You asked me what honorary degrees. I told you that in 1925, Kansas State gave me an honorary degree of Doctor of Engineering. In 1936, Norwich gave me. That was no 1936. I was given the Doctor of Science from Northeastern. In 1944, I was given an LLD. I was given a Doctor of Science, LLD from Norwich University. In 1947, a Doctor of Science from Alfred.
Was that because Mr. Walters was there,
yes,
wasn't he? Mm-hmm.
And the same year, the honorary doctor's degree from Rose Polytechnic. In 49, Doctor of Engineering from South Dakota School of Mines. In 53, Doctor of Science from Northwestern. In 55, Doctor of Engineering Purdue. 56, Doctor of Engineering from Michigan State. 64, Doctor of Engineering, Indiana Institute of Technology. I think the details of those honors you will find in a record which I gave you with dates.
And which will be incorporated into this. Of all, do you want to go say which one pleased you most?
I rather think I would put Kansas State University first, Purdue second, and Michigan State third.
Why Michigan State?
Michigan State, in 1953, only a few days after I retired, the president of Michigan State wanted me to come. He said, to do two things. First of all, his dean of many years had retired, and he wanted to be able to take a year or more in selecting a dean. Secondly, he says, to get my help for me to select the dean for him. Thirdly, he said he had been invited by Charlie Wilson, who was at that time head of defense, to act as assistant secretary of defense. And I told him I greatly appreciate the honor. I said, but I am president of Bitumen School Research. So as a matter of fact, I gave part-time to Bitumen School Research for 3 years before I retired. I said I have been appointed by President Truman, a member on the first board of the National Science Foundation. And that takes several days a month. I say I'm consultant for the air preheater company and a member of its board. I'm consultant for Worthington. I'm consultant even for a manufacturer of silverware and a number of other companies, and I said, I can't throw those things up. So a few minutes later, Mr. Wilson called me, Secretary of Defense. Mr. Wilson says, President Hanna of Michigan State will not accept the position of Assistant Secretary unless you pinch it for him, take care of faculty matters, meetings of the trustees, some talks that have to be given, so that he can discharge his duties as Assistant Secretary of Defense. And I said, well, Mr. Wilson, the country comes first, and a request from you is an honor. I say, but even then, I have certain ethical responsibilities. I said, I can't drop the Science Foundation. I can't drop Bitumen School Research. It's a sick industry. And I'm doing my very best to get it back on its feet. I said, what I'll do, I said, I can take care of the matters you have in mind by giving you, say, 1 or 2 days every week or two. I say, what I'll do, I will give as much time as is necessary to keep the president's office running during the absence of Mr. Hanna. I know most of the faculty in engineering, they don't need a straw boss around them. They need somebody who can help coordinate things, to be ready to utilize my experience in advising them. I said, I'll find somebody to take Dean Miller's place, again in cooperation with the faculty. As I never appointed, I never selected anybody, unless it was a choice of the faculty. So I'll work with the faculty, we'll together, I'll bring in certain people, I'll ask through my acquaintanceship for suggestions, we'll look them over, and then we'll select somebody. And I said, I will not accept the president's salary. I said, I'm having a salary from Bethune School of Research, which is about what I had at Purdue. I don't need any more. And I said, but if you think I ought to accept some compensation, I'll just charge you a per dime. I'll charge Michigan State a per dime, as I do for any other consulting job that I have. Maybe a little lower, because I don't think the fee to an educational institution should be as high. So that was arranged, and I said for a year. Now Hannah insisted that I take much more as an honorarium than I dreamt of taking. But I was able to find a person to take over as Dean of Engineering. I kept the various divisions of the institution functioning. I called up President Hanna practically every day or two to report on certain things that I did or that I should do and get his advice, and things run smoothly. So Hanna wanted to give me a degree in 1954, but 54 I was tied up somewhere else and couldn't come, so they gave it to me, I think, in 55. But my connection with the Michigan State was a very, very happy one. First of all, Hanna is another one of the greatest presidents of land-grant cultures. I think I would put Hanna and Stone among the top people in the land-grant cultures I've known during the past 60 years. And it was marvelous to me what he has been able to accomplish. Yes, sir.
You certainly built up the university. You know, once, when we're talking about college presidents, once upon a time you told me of a very amusing encounter you had with A. Lawrence Lowe of Harvard.
Yeah.
Who, weren't you calling on him once, and he said something about MIT being a factory down the river or something?
Well, in 1923, the then Office of Education of the Department of Interior invited me to make a survey of higher education in the state of Massachusetts. And I'll show you later the report of the survey.
We can incorporate it, yes.
Which, with particular reference to engineering. The labor unions of Massachusetts felt that Massachusetts should have a state university where students can enter without any regard to their preparation. Anybody wanted to go there should be able to go there. They wouldn't have to pay any fees or any tuition. That idea is not very different from some of our students of today.
But this was the labor unions.
Labor unions. And I made a survey. And before making the survey, I decided to call on the top people of the leading institutions of higher learning of Massachusetts. I called President Lowell first. He's very polite to me. I don't think he knew or realized that Purdue University was a state institution. I know he didn't know that that Massachusetts Institute of Technology was a land grant institution. And he told me about the setup in Massachusetts with Harvard, the oldest university in the country, of course, whose reputation I knew, I was acquainted with. He told me of Clark, which did a good deal in developing graduate work on a pattern which was set up in Johns Hopkins. And he says, then there is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology on Boylston Street, which trains people as technicians and subordinate people for industry. The leaders in industry, the top leaders, come from institutions like Harvard and Yale. And he didn't think it would be very much worthwhile for me to spend much time at MIT or at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, which is another kind of a school which is largely responsible for training of technicians. He thought that I ought to visit Clark at Worcester. He told me about some of the denominational institutions, some under Catholic control, some under Protestant control. It was very helpful. If you want to, I'll lend you a copy of my report. When I made the report, I reported against the state university, against Massachusetts starting a state university at that time.
That is, a state university under the terms, as was suggested.
I felt that the present facility, the then facilities in 1923, for higher education in Massachusetts, in liberal arts, the sciences, in engineering, and other fields, is adequate. I felt that the Massachusetts Agricultural College at Amherst, which is a part of the land grant college, you see, Massachusetts, when the land grant act was passed, nobody wanted to have anything to do with it. Harvard was given a chance to establish a division or a school, but they didn't want to. So Massachusetts, they started the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in a few rooms in Somers Street, not very far from the present South Railroad
station. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have a clear idea what it was. But so I felt that for the present, that Massachusetts should go along as it is. Give a little better support to Amherst. Give a little encouragement to, I spoke about Northeastern in my report too. I felt there is an institution which is doing a very good job, and the state may wish to consider to give a little help to that institution. Anyway, it established a few scholarships there, and paid scholarships for outstanding students. So to give them some help.
You know, you haven't mentioned Boston University.
Boston University I didn't visit because it was not, at that time, it was purely a church supported liberal arts college.
Yeah.
And I felt they have their place. I think in my report I mentioned of the importance of the church supported schools such as Boston College, Boston University, some of the other institutions that I knew, but I didn't visit any of them, because I was asked to about a state university with particular reference to engineering. You see, my job was mainly engineering. Does that answer your question?
That answers my question, because I know you told me once that you and Mr. Lowell, that you had met Mr. Lowell and talked to him about the other president of Harvard, whom you knew much more intimately, Mr. Conant. Do you have anything you'd like to say about Mr. Conant?
No. Conant was a chemist. I first became acquainted with Conant, the professor of chemistry at Purdue, had retired, and they were looking for a new head of chemistry. And President Eliot, at the suggestion of the trustees, suggested that I be asked to interview Jim Conant, because I knew people at Harvard, and and they thought that they could introduce me to Conant. I found James Conant working in his laboratory. He didn't have an office. He didn't want to have an office. He interviewed people in his laboratory. He was working there. He was an organic chemist, and a very good one at that. And I told him what my mission was. I told him I was asked whether he may be available for consideration by the Board of Trustees. I told him something about Purdue, my impressions of Purdue, its potentialities, the fact that its first president, that it's one of the great, the first president I knew at Purdue, Stone, was a chemist, a food chemist from Amherst, that the present president was educated really as a chemist in his bachelor's work at the University of Nebraska, then later on to graduate work at the Teachers College at Columbia. And I told him that chemistry has always had a high place at Purdue. It's of great importance to the major branches, such as agriculture, engineering, and home economics. Mr. Conant thanked me for it and wanted me to express appreciation to the administration and trustees, but he said he did not want to give up his teaching and his research in chemistry. I became very well acquainted with Jim Conant while we were together on the first board of the National Science Foundation. He was a delightful presiding officer. He was not an executive.
I think his career at Harvard would indicate that.
He was not an executive. He should have never been invited to become president or any other administrative position. I think if he had been encouraged to continue in organic chemistry, he probably would have been one of the most distinguished organic chemists in the world. And Compton, in many ways, was a much more interesting person than Conant. Carl Compton was born in a distinguished family. The father was a minister and the first president of a church institution in Ohio. Three sons and one daughter distinguished themselves. Carl Compton became great in the field of physics at Princeton, and later on was president at MIT. His brother, Arthur, distinguished himself as professor of physics at the University of Chicago. Later on was at the Washington University St. Louis, was a Nobel Prize winner. The third one, Wilson Compton, was president of Washington State College at Pullman, Washington. He was not distinguished as a scientist. He was more the businessman and public relations man, but had a very good idea of applications of science and made a satisfactory Lane Grant College president. I wouldn't say outstanding, not of the caliber of Hannah or of Stone, but a satisfactory. Then the daughter was a missionary in India and made a great contribution to the population of that land through her personality and interests. So it was a great, great institution.
Did you know any of the presidents of places like University of Chicago well, or any of our other Big Ten schools?
I knew Michelson, who was not president, who was professor. Okay. I knew Bob Milliken. I knew Michelson very well. He was a Nobel Prize winner at Chicago. At Ohio State, the person, people impressed me most, there was W. Thompson, who was president of Ohio State for many, many years, who was the son of a shoemaker, became a minister of religion. Then, as was customary at that time, was made president of Ohio State and served with great distinction. He built up that institution. That institution also made the ceramic industry of this country and probably made the most significant contribution to the development of plastics, Ohio State University. Its professor who developed ceramic engineering was E.A. Wharton Jr., who later on became dean of its College of Engineering. A very colorful individual and very much of an applied scientist. I mentioned Cooley in Michigan State. There was a member named of Anson Marston, civil engineer, a graduate of Cornell, who taught civil engineering at Iowa State College, but who made a very great contribution to the development of agricultural engineering. He's the one who encouraged J.B. Davidson to develop some of the earlier books in agricultural engineering, and who served as the first president of the American Society of Agricultural Engineers. I spoke of Dougal Jackson, who made a great impression on the electrical engineering profession. He was professor of electrical engineering at Purdue. I mean at MIT.
Did you know any, did you know people well, like Jerome Frank when he was at Wisconsin? And
no.
You did not know Frank?
I met him. I knew Frank. I knew Little. At Michigan.
Michigan?
Very well. In fact, Little wanted me to succeed Cooley. But I felt that my place is at Purdue. With Ross.
Yes.
As he was, what he gave of himself, my wife was very definitely of the opinion that I would do well to stay and work with Ross and Elliot rather than to go to Michigan or to any other place.
Did you know Robert Hutchins when he was at Chicago?
I had very unhappy contacts with him. I thought he was the most, I think he was worse than De Gaulle, except I don't think he had any brains. I think Robert Hutchins, I felt, on account of, was one of the most dangerous people we had in higher education. I was consultant for a number of years for Samuel Insull. Samuel Insull was interested in establishing in Chicago a center for graduate study and research. I tried my best to tell him he ought to move it to Lafayette, but he was an Englishman who had his own views. And he wanted me to talk to the president of Chicago, to Hutchins. I knew that Elliot, president of Purdue, knew Hutchins quite well. So I asked, told Elliot what I'm after. I'd like to have an introduction to Hutchins. I heard from some of my friends at Yale that he was a most difficult and most unreliable fellow you could deal with. So I wanted to get a proper kind of introduction. I went up to see him. And he practically insulted me. He told me there is no such a thing as engineering, that we ought not have such places like Purdue or MIT or any of those.
How would he propose to do the work that they do and not
by
have
apprenticeship.
Them exist? By what?
By apprenticeship.
Oh, I see. In other words, his idea of an engineer was a man who operated
blacksmith.
A boiler. Or a blacksmith.
Yes. And he didn't think there is such thing as graduate study in engineering. And he was so nasty. I went back to Mr. Insull and I said, call in Mr. Gear. Gear was vice president of Commonwealth Edison Company, which was an Insull property, and chairman of the board of the University of Chicago. So I said, Mr. Insull, I'm calling him up. I said, I'm coming over to your office on a matter of great importance to you in connection with a chore you assigned me to. That is building up a graduate school of engineering in Chicago. But I'd like to have Mr. Keir, who is chairman of the board, at this conference, because I don't want Gear to get something secondhand. And I told Gear that my experiences with Hutchins. I said, absolutely not. He had in mind of giving, to start with, at least $25 million. That was during his good times, don't you say, before, and he...
Well, that isn't the only money that Mr. Hutchins lost by this kind of thing.
But Elliot invited him to be the guest of Purdue University to address the faculty. That was before I went to see him. And we had a reception for him, and we had a dinner where the faculty was invited. He spent his time running down Purdue and the land grant college idea and the kind of institution he is. At that time, one of our famous people at Purdue was a professor by the name of Arthur, who was a specialist on rusts. When Hutchins came down here, he had already been retired for several years. And Elliot said to him, he says, now, before you leave Lafayette, I want you to meet one of our retired professors, who is a great scholar and a specialty of rusts. And I want you to see him. Elliot says he absolutely insulted Arthur, and as well as him. Elliot was wanted to play up to Hutchins, but his experiences with him in connection with Dr. Arthur, and my report on my conference with him about the proposed gift by Insull, cooked Hutchins, so far as Elliot is concerned, never paying attention to him afterwards. I felt that Hutchins did a great deal of harm to higher education in the United States. He couldn't hurt Chicago because it had such an unusual staff, so many famous people, and they never took him too seriously. They let him talk, but they paid no attention to it.
What do you think of Northwestern?
Wonderful. I think Northwestern and Northeastern are two institutions which are, to me, a miracle. I spoke to you with Northeastern, which was nothing but a Boston YMCA. And they, the way it developed into the largest and best institution on the cooperative plan, you know, where the students work part-time and go to school one time. The alumni of Northeastern University and their contributions to our country, as well as to Northeastern, would make a very excellent story. Now, Northwestern, when I faced Northwestern, it was a sectarian school, Methodist school. They taught a little engineering. It was never respected as an engineering school. Well, at that time it wasn't. He did pretty well in the area of speech, rather early, you know, elocution we used to call it. They had a rather famous people on elocution. They had a few areas where they did well, but it wasn't an outstanding institution. The person who really gave the push to Northwestern was Dill Scott, who was a sociologist and a man of ideas, a miserable speaker, but a person of character who could be trusted. People respected him, and he started in getting encouragement from some of the industries in Chicago. Murphy, who was a builder of railroad equipment, wanted to give away $25 million to encourage the development of engineering education. I knew Murphy very well. I brought him here to meet Elliot and Ross, but he laid down certain things. First of all, he said he wanted the school to be organized on the cooperative plan, and nothing but the cooperative plan. I told him that I personally I'm very much in favor of the cooperative plan, but I wouldn't be in favor of having nothing but a cooperative plan. I told him an institution as large as Purdue, see at that time, that was the late 30s, that we couldn't find enough jobs, particularly in case there was a certain amount of instability, the economic instability. I told him I'd be in favor of seeing Purdue encourage cooperative education and have a certain portion, which we did even then. Even then we had maybe a couple hundred who were going to school one semester and working one semester. But he wanted the cooperative plan. The second thing was that he was to decide who is going to be dean of the school, that he's going to select the faculty, and that he was going to have a voice in the kind of curriculum.
Are you
and Ross told him absolutely not. He said it's the responsibility of the trustees to aid the president to select and appoint with the advice and approval of the faculty members of the staff, including deans. That's the function of the faculty, without interference with trustees, to plan and organize and administer programs of study. He didn't use exactly that English, but that was his thought.
Yes.
And he said he thought that he would give whatever he wants to give to Purdue University, that speaking for the trustees and he thanks for the faculty, he can guarantee him that it will be used in the interest of the railroads and the American industry, as we have demonstrated before. But he cannot accept the conditions.
Yes, of course.
I understand he approached Hutchins also, and he went away discouraged. And somebody had suggested that he contact Dean Scott. And Dean Scott, they didn't have any engineering setup there. They had one man who was called Dean of Engineering, but he was about ready to retire. They had a very small faculty. And Scott said that he thought that he could use, they'd be very glad to be guided by him, provided Murphy didn't jump and appoint it, and not appoint people. And also, if he would consult with some of the leaders in education and in the industry before he made suggestions for appointments. So, Murphy went to Kettering. And Kettering was the one who was very much in favor of cooperative education. Kettering suggested a man who had a very important position. His name was Eshbaugh, with the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, who was interested in people, had really charge of their personnel system, although he was an electrical engineer, wrote a handbook on engineering, electrical engineering. And Eshbaugh was the first dean. And the initial donation contribution by Murphy was 25 million. And that gave, Northwestern the impetus. Then Scott also was very wise. They've selected Miller, a medical doctor of Chicago, to come there as dean of the medical school. And Miller succeeded Dale Scott as president. And Northwestern had its growth in size and support and prestige largely under Miller's leadership.
Is that so?
Who is one of the, another one of the very, very outstanding presidents.
Well, you know, in our talks, you haven't said much about engineering at Minnesota.
Engineering at Minnesota, I wouldn't say, I'd be very glad to quote it, because it's true. I wouldn't put them in the same class with many institutions of the state, of the land-grant colleges. I suddenly would put MIT, Illinois, Purdue, California, Wisconsin, way, way ahead of Minnesota.
Now, when
Minnesota
talk-
has not had too good leadership in engineering education. They had a president of Kauffman who got, received his doctor's degree at Yale, at Columbia, at the same time that Elliott of Purdue received his doctor's degree. But he wasn't Elliott. He wasn't as high a grade a man as Elliott. And Kauffman didn't do too well. They've had some great people. We had a Purdue alumnus there who was in their faculty, who developed taconite, probably the greatest thing ever happened.
In the
metal mining industry. They've had several people in recent years in the field of heat transfer that were rather outstanding. But I wouldn't say that Minnesota, in engineering or agriculture, I don't know where their home economy is, compares with Iowa State, Purdue, Ohio State, MIT, any of those.
Now, Iowa has Ames is the...
Ames and Iowa City.
Ames and Iowa City, but Ames is the Iowa version of Purdue. It's an excellent
university. It's the land-grant college. It's called the Iowa State University.
Iowa was fortunate
in really developing two institutions of higher learning that are quality institutions. Both the State University of Iowa and Iowa State College at Ames. The State University is located at Iowa City. At Iowa City, one of the men who gave the greatest impetus to that institution was a member named of Seashore, who was a psychologist interested really in music and tying in music with psychology. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but he really had a good deal to do in the encouragement of the earlier people in psychiatry as well as psychology.
He trained Mr. Knight, didn't he, who came to
Purdue? Yes. He trained Knight, but he did very outstanding work. I would say he was the most outstanding man. Well, they had a person in hydraulics. They had a hydraulics laboratory that probably would be ranked among the two or three best in the country. But in engineering, it was ordinary. Ames I would say he was superior. There was no comparison between the record of the alumni of Ames and of Iowa City. Just as this, you very seldom will find tops of major industries graduate from Minnesota, don't you say? Wisconsin, yes. I would say that Wisconsin and Purdue, next to MIT and MIT, were the three land-grant colleges who had the best record of successful alumni in industry. I wouldn't put Illinois in the same category.
Is that so?
I'd put Ohio State ahead of Illinois.
Ohio
State alumni, not only in ceramics, but in electrical engineering and mechanical engineering, have done particularly well. Kettering is a graduate of Ohio State.
By the way, sir, we haven't said one word about the University of Missouri's engineering school.
Missouri?
Does it have a good engineering school in the state of Missouri?
Fair.
Just fair?
Fair. Just, I wouldn't put it in the same class with most of the land-grant colleges.
When you get south, we discussed Rice for a moment, but when you get south, what about places like, say, Georgia Tech?
Well, Georgia Tech is a good school. Tulane is a good school. University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa. I've been honorary professor at that institution for many years of engineering. And they're good, there are schools that are good, but not superior or extraordinary. I would say that the
problem lie in finance?
Finance and the quality of management. The president of Georgia Tech until just a few months ago was his doctor's degree from Purdue, and I was his major professor. I recommended him. His president, his predecessor, Van Leer, is another student of mine in electrical engineering. The Harrison, who is the present president in mechanical engineering, Harrison is retiring because he thought 10 years as president of an institution is enough. And he's a very superior fellow, but not quite strong enough to develop a faculty that has gone, that has developed in a very conservative way. I think Van Leer did a great deal in improving its athletic situation.
That's interesting, the two Purdue people.
Pardon me?
That is interesting. The two Purdue people should have been gone to Georgia Tech.
I recommended Van Leer. He was dean of engineering at the University of Florida. And they asked me for advice. And I gave him two or three names, and I gave him Van Leer. They selected Van Leer. Then when Van Leer died, had a heart attack, the chairman of the board called me up and said, "Now you know when one turn deserves another turn." That's what they said. When Bill turned, Mary turned. He said, "You recommend Van Leer, and Van Leer helped build up Georgia Tech of today," which he did. And he said, "Have you any suggestions?" I said, "Yes, I have." I said, "You want to get somebody who comes from the South, or no Southern people?" I said, "A young man, Harrison, was a graduate of Annapolis, was a naval officer, was a submarine commander, retired shortly after the Second World War, went to the Virginia Polytechnic Institute, earned his master's degree there, came to Purdue and earned his doctorate, taught at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute, went back to Virginia Polytechnic, did very well there." I say, I, the president of University of Toledo, who is now president of Northeastern, Knowles, asked me to recommend him somebody who would take the place of an individual who had been dean of engineering at Toledo, and I recommended Harrison as dean. So they shifted him from an assistant or associate professor at Virginia Polytechnic Institute as dean of engineering at Toledo. He made a wonderful record. He was there maybe 2 or 3 years when the chairman of the board of trustees of Georgia Tech called me. He wanted to know whether I could get a replacement for my Purdue alumnus as a replacement. And I told him, I said, now, Harrison would fit. He was born in Arkansas. He's a southerner. He's a graduate of Annapolis. And for some reason or other, people trained at Annapolis get a certain culture, a certain development, which is very distinctive. He's very much of a gentleman. He has a wife who is a perfect southern girl. And I said, I think he'd fit. I said, however, I don't want you to approach him. You call up, you get in contact with President Knowles, who is president of Toledo, and tell him what had happened, that you had called me, that Van Leer was a Purdue alumnus, he was so pleased with him, you wanted to use me in helping him get one. And tell President Knowles that I said the man that would be my choice would be Harrison, who is his dean of engineering, I said. I said, tell him that I haven't the heart to suggest that you approach him because he's been there only 2 or 3 years. He's making wonderful progress in developing Toledo into a good institution, and they will not approach him. But if President Knowles feels that they should, that he could let that it would be in the interest of Harrison to go there, then approach him. Knowles asked them what his salary would be, and they told him. And he says, that's about double what he's getting with us, what we can afford. He says, approach him. So he went there. Knowles called me up and told me that he appreciates my attitude towards him about that thing, but he didn't feel, he thought Harrison did so well. Harrison did well at Georgia Tech, but a number of the present situations, you know, you're speaking about the money. Georgia Tech has had difficulty, the same way some of the other institutions in the South, although you take even the University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa, they're getting some pretty good people.
Good.
They're doing better.
What about places like Oklahoma State and Texas A&M?
Well, they are, I wouldn't say, my son was head of the physics department there at Texas A&M for 22 years. So I have a certain interest, although I had nothing to do with him going there. They're getting pretty good support at Texas A&M, and I think Oklahoma is getting, A&M is getting the support.
Oklahoma has quite a building program.
They have a building program, but there hasn't been the appreciation of scholarship and the place of the professor, the dignity of the colleague at the institutions like Oklahoma, Texas A&M. Texas University, which isn't very much better support than Texas A&M, has a very much better image. You see, Oklahoma University at Norman, I'm very well acquainted. I think it's slightly better than A&M.
What about Stillwater?
Stillwater is where A&M is. And I'm a civil right in there. But it's something about the leadership and tradition that my son and his wife like Texas A&M very much, but the lack of appreciation of good teaching and of scholarship standards and scholarly part on the faculty prompted my son at the age of 58 or 59, after 22 years service, to leave there and go to Florida Institute of Technology, which is a new school. Of course, partly it was his spirit of innovation and development. It's a new school. It's 25 miles or less from Cape Kennedy. It has an unusual clientele. Half of the professors have full-time positions at the center, at the Air Center. And that risk-taking, that pioneer spirit, which characterizes so many people in this country, prompted my son to leave A&M and go to that little school where he has a much heavier load. I don't think his salary can be as high because they just have the money. They don't get any state support. They don't want state support. They're getting along with gifts and tuition. And the people come there because they think it's quality rather than because the state is supporting it. But I believe the institutions of the South, they've really produced scholarly work too late at New Orleans. University of Louisiana, much bigger, but not quite the quality, see? At Texas, Rice. There's a Rice Institute.
Yes, we've talked about that.
Which is a quality institution. It's a private institution.
Yes.
In California, California is fortunate in having University of California, which has attracted scholars in the past. They have probably more Nobel Prize winners than any institution in the country except Harvard.
It's interesting. Do you think a Nobel Prize winner is an addition to the faculty of a university?
It depends on the Nobel Prize winner.
In other words, on the man.
Pardon, on the man.
But would you think on the whole, if you had a dozen Nobel Prize winners, you're apt to have in their area men of quality and of leadership on the campus?
No, just because a person. I knew Nobel Prize winners. You take Arthur Compton. You take Bob Millikan, were Nobel Prize winners. They were excellent teachers, great humanists. As I mentioned before, Doctor, I think the most important attribute of a person on a faculty of a university is affection, respect, and interest in people. It requires certain to be able to teach, honest, to be able to sell. I think the attributes of the salesman and the teacher, and it ought to be of the manager, ought to be the same. A manager like Gerard Swope, who was the great president of the General Electric Company, he sold himself to people, not because he was made president or held a high position, not because he was a brilliant engineer, but through his human qualities. They never had any labor troubles at General Electric when Swope was president. Swope was in a very soft voice, rather shy, but loved people, and people loved him. And it's so when you speak with Nobel Prize winner, now you take it to Purdue, that man Brown in chemistry, who I think is going to have a Nobel Prize one of these days if he is the type. There was a man in biophysics, I forgot his name now. I think he still is here.
Beavers?
Huh?
Beavers? Beavers?
How do you spell it?
B-E-A-V-E-R-S,
Harry
B.
No,
no.
Somebody else, he's in biochemistry, biophysics.
Wasn't Zorro, was it?
No, he was a great teacher. It's a question of a teaching ability. I know of people at Purdue who have made great reputations in their field, as engineers, for instance, who are useless insofar as the students are concerned, insofar as creativity of the department, they are nothing. So it isn't a question of just honors or degrees.
Scholarship.
And it has to be, scholarship is a very important thing, but the main attribute is interest, love for people.
Very good. Now, is there any point, any topic that we've omitted in our conversations?
I don't know.
Anything you'd like to talk about?
Let us get that transcript.
Very
after
good.
You worked it up, and then probably I'll take the liberty of inserting certain things and removing certain things.
All right.
Then you can make it a little matter of.
Well, then this we'll call this the end of the interview at tape of number four. Okay. All right, sir.